The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I had promised to do something else and I hadn't forgotten about that, and I will come back to it. My sort of, you know, thinking about how to reconstruct the political and economic landscape purely from first principles and see what that tells us about the current world. However, I did a live Brokenomics a couple of weeks back, and somebody asked very nicely if I could take a look at silver. And I thought, well, yes, why not? So let's talk about silver and what's going on with metals at the moment, because it is getting quite interesting. And also there are quite a lot of takes on Twitter that I would love to be true, but they're just really not. So that needs calling out as well. So gold and silver. So, I mean, they weren't chosen as money in the first place because of any sort of great mysticism or anything. They emerged organically because what they did is they solved a hard coordination problem in early economies. If you need to be able to ship value over long distance, and in the early world, I mean, you had supply chains that went from Cornwall to supplying tin down into bloody Egypt because it was Bronze Age and you needed tin and you couldn't get tin from very many places. So it's long been an issue that you need to transport value over long distance. And actually at that time, it was largely copper. And you kind of got into a phase after that, basically for the rest of history, where, gold was your sort of state level money. This is your palace money. Silver is your, effectively, your middle class money. It's sort of daily commerce, that kind of thing. Lesser metals like copper or bronze might be used at as your street level, you know, buying a bloody loaf of bread or something like that. And none of this was sort of planned or ideological. It was just practical. You know, metals are they're scarce and they're valuable and they're perfectly useful for everyday transactions. Gold is a little bit too big though, so silver kind of fills the gap. In between them, you get into what we had for most of history, which is this bimetallism, whatever they call it, standard, where you had gold and silver as money for a high, long time. And, gold was high-level money and silver was working money, effectively. And, you know, that carried on for, most of history. And then by the 19th century, industrialization and global trade had started to expose a bit of flaw in this because you had a fixed exchange rate between gold and silver. And it increasingly became unstable as supply and demand shifted unevenly between those two metals. And so states increasingly chose gold alone as the anchor that they wanted for this system. To simplify settlement and reduce volatility for their point of view. And so silver was gradually demonetized in the sort of 19th century. not because it failed, but because managing two different fixed price points became administratively and increasingly so, difficult. So silver didn't fail as money. It was kind of abandoned as money. And the decisive shift was in the 20th century. You know, gold became at that point the explicit reserve asset. Silver became coinage, and then increasingly not even that, just an industrial metal. Gold maintained its monetary prestige, and silver, you know, at best you could say oscillated between money and commodity, and increasingly commodity. So 1971 is the first kind of big touchstone we need to hit upon if we're going to do the history of, well, the recent history of these two metals. 1971, the system was anchored to gold, which was lovely because this placed hard constraints on politicians' spending. However, politicians were like, yeah, sod that, I want power, so I'm going to make all of these promises and it doesn't matter if I can't back them up. This came to hit hard in the US in 1971 when basically it just didn't have enough gold to meet the promises. And this is 1971, mind. Imagine the size of the US state in 1971 compared to where it is today. Even by 1971, the state had basically run out of money because politicians kept making promises in order to get elected that they couldn't then deliver on. So Nixon broke the conversion into from US dollars into gold. And basically after that, money became pieces of paper, which were unbacked by anything other than the promises of politicians. And obviously that didn't work well. So since that time, you know, gold prices have really signaled something. They've signaled confidence in the monetary regime itself. And indeed, I think it was one of the Federal Reserves, Alan Greenspan. He said that every morning, the first thing when he walked into his office, he wanted to know was what was the gold price, because he wanted to know if his paper money maintained credibility. And he knew if the gold price went too high, that meant that his paper money was losing credibility and they needed to back off a bit. So gold conveyed confidence in the monetary regime. And silver, the price of silver, it kind of amplified the stress and growth cycles. I'll explain what I mean more when I come into that. I mean, effectively, after 1971, gold measured trust in money, and silver managed or signalled stress in the money, or stress in the system as a whole. Okay, so why this matters now, why I bring this up on a discussion about what's currently happening in gold and silver, is that most modern commentators, and most of what you see on Twitter and all the rest of it, they're treating gold and silver as similar assets with different levels of volatility. Now, historically, that has been wrong. Gold is about reserves and settlement, and silver is about throughput and industry and marginal demand. But when both of these things are moving together, well, that kind of indicates that something structural is happening and going on here. Let's quickly go through the major inflection points on the history of this, because I think it is instructive. So history is full of gold and silver rallies. And honestly, very few of them ever matters. So most metal spikes or precious metal spikes, they're going to be, you know, cyclical because of inflation scares, or they're going to be crisis hedge, something like that. But a regime change is different because it permanently alters how metals are used and priced. So big moves are common. Regime changes are rare. Which one are we in at the moment? So the 1930s, the state, the US, repriced gold. So, you know, it didn't move because of markets, it's because the state repriced the fixed exchange into dollars. And it mattered because it proved something fairly fundamental, that in stress, gold is not discovered by markets, it's reasserted its power. Because ultimately, money actually really is gold, not these pieces of paper. And silver didn't play in that, but gold did. So that's 1930s. Bretton Woods is probably the next one. This kind of regime that lasted effectively between 1944, the end of the war, and 1971, which I've already talked about. So gold sat kind of quietly behind the curtain, and currencies were pegged to it, and volatility was suppressed. All looked good. But like I say, the politicians couldn't maintain the discipline, so that all broke down. The post-1971 period, so the 70s, you know, up to about the 80s, when gold conversion had ended, trust moved from metal to policy, which is mad now you think about it, but markets really did respect that trust. They really did believe in the pieces of paper. So the 1970s metal move was not about inflation alone. It was about whether fiat could function without an anchor. And gold did reprice upwards. Silver overshot violently at that time. If you in 1970, you should have bought gold and silver, especially silver. And because it was a genuine regime shock that had taken place. And I mean, I suppose the key takeaway on that would be that when monetary credibility breaks, you know, metals don't hedge it, they just revalue. And maybe that's what's going on at the moment. So let's go from, I don't know, 1980 to maybe 2000. You know, credibility was largely restored. Volcker, he managed to instill, which is a different episode getting into all that, but Paul Volcker, he restored confidence in the system. High real rates, fiscal discipline, political will to get inflation under control. And during that period, gold and silver didn't really need to be manipulated because they were suppressed by the belief of everybody acting within the system. And so that period taught markets kind of the wrong lesson. It taught them that precious metals were obsolete. And quite frankly, you don't need suppression when confidence is doing the job for you, because if everybody believes that these pieces of paper are good, then yeah, why do you need precious metals? 2008, that's probably the next big junction point. The Great Financial Crisis, it produced a strong metals rally. Quantitative easing, bailouts, fear of collapse. But the system did survive, hollowed, rotten, but it did survive. And confidence was bruised and not broken. This is when I got into precious metals in 2008. In fact, a little bit before 2008, because I was... you know how standard economists always say, nobody saw the Great Financial Crisis coming. Well, yeah, basically everybody who was an Austrian economist saw it coming. And being an Austrian economist or of that bent, then I obviously saw it coming as well. So I was buying gold and physical gold and silvers, the coins and the bars. So silver did spike and then it crashed. I seem to remember now that it went up to $50 per ounce and then it came off quite hard. But my takeaway from that was, okay, am I wrong or is the system belief thing just kicking back in? And I came to the conclusion this is fundamentally unstable, clearly. And yes, okay, people have decided to trust the whole banking system again, but I'm just going to carry on buying silver. And so, yes, I bought silver on the way up to 50, and then when it came down the other side, I didn't freak out. I just carried on buying silver. And actually, I was quite happy that for the years after that, I was able to buy silver at sometimes, you know, like $15 an ounce is like fantastic. I'll just keep doing that then. So, but nevertheless, it does indicate that most crises don't reorder the system. Most of these crises are actually just absorbed. And just because a system is built on bad foundations doesn't mean it won't last your entire lifetime. So you need to be aware of that. 2022, well, somewhere in that region anyway, maybe 2020, that was a kind of quiet structural break, and this was where things changed. Fiscal and monetary policy fused permanently, and I don't think that one is ever going to unfuse now, not until there's a major system shock or something fundamentally changes in the system. Oh, and the other thing is that reserves were weaponized via things like sanctions. Now, at this point, all around the world, states their buying of gold accelerates, and by quite a lot, because at this point trust has fractured along geopolitical lines, and it wasn't loud, and you know, it wasn't a big spectacle, but it was structural, and states and central banks around the world, they understood it, and so kind of quietly they just start buying a lot more gold regularly. So what's actually happening now? Gold and silver are rising together, perhaps for different reasons, and this is unusual, and I think it does matter. So gold and silver often move together directionally, but rarely for the same underlying reasons at the same time. And when that happens, it usually signals something a bit deeper than just a trade or something happening in the cycle. You know, right now, gold is rising steadily and persistently, and silver is rising faster, more violently, and with more visible stress. The divergence in behavior is the signal here, I think. You know, when gold and silver rise together but behave differently, the system is under strain. So gold's move is, I think, a reclassification, not necessarily a panic. Don't think it is that. It isn't spiking and then collapsing. It isn't reacting cleanly to yields, government yields. It isn't selling off when, you know, fear recesses a bit. Instead, it appears to have been reclassified from, you know, perhaps an insurance asset to a strategic reserve asset, thus the central bank and the state buying. And it's driven by, you know, this persistent central bank accumulation, and it's driven by the geopolitical fragmentation that's happening at the moment. And essentially, it's a decline in trust in the neutral settlement via just fiat, the pieces of paper system. So gold is not hedging here, it's repricing its role. So gold is being bought for reasons that ignore price. People are not saying, I want to buy gold at this price. They're saying, I want to buy gold. And whatever the price is, I will pay that price in order to get some. And most of the gold buyers, they're sovereign or they're at least quasi-sovereign. And, you know, they're policy-driven, not return-driven. They're not trying to make a turn on this. And actually, they're relatively price-insensitive. Price goes up, fine, I have to pay that then. And it matters for the gold price because that creates a persistent bid and it weakens the whole traditional valuation anchor thing. And it kind of lifts the long-term floor. So gold's marginal buyer has changed. And as a result, the market has changed. The silver move, however, is kind of inheritance plus amplification. You could look at it like that. Silver inherits gold's monetary signal, but adds three quite strong amplifiers onto that. For a start, it's a much smaller market. It's got a worse supply structure and it's got a large industrial base demand. So that means that the same flows move silver more and that the physical tightness in the supply shows up faster. And as a result, volatility is going to be, well, it's unavoidable. So silver is not just catching up, it's overexpressing the same signal. You know, silver is gold's megaphone, effectively, in this case. So why silver looks chaotic while gold looks calm and steady is that gold supply is mostly primary, as in dig it up. And it responds slowly but predictably, and it's hoarded by design. That's what you do with gold. Silver supply is mostly a byproduct, mining other metals, and it responds indirectly, right? And it is consumed continuously. It's in a lot of, you know, electrics and stuff like that. Apparently, a Tomahawk cruise missile has about 15 kilograms worth of silver in it. And, I mean, that's a lot of silver, isn't it? I mean, I suppose Tomahawk missiles are expensive, but still, you get my point. And you're not getting your silver back. You're not recycling, unless you never use it, then you might recycle it. But, you know, if the ones that gets used, you're not going there and getting the silver afterwards. So, you know, gold kind of absorbs the stress in the signal, but silver, its job is to kind of reveal that stress through its higher volatility. And I don't think this is just an inflation trade. It's not. Because if it were inflation, then gold would track inflation expectations cleanly, and it doesn't. And silver would lag that or decouple from it, and it isn't. And industrial metals would lead, and they're not. And that's not what we're seeing. Gold moves independently of short-term inflation data. Like I said, it's got that persistent bid to it. Silver moves with both monetary and industrial pressure. It's responding to both. And correlations are unstable between the two. So it's not just about price rising, it's about the underlying level of confidence of the people in the system have. That's what's going on. And, you know, what actually links gold and silver right now is declining confidence in paper money settlement and the rising importance of actual physical settlement. We come on to talk about, you know, how gold and silver is often traded on exchange markets, COMEX, all that stuff. And what you're seeing, there's a lot of people saying, no, I actually want the gold and silver. I don't just want to roll these contracts over. And it's fundamentally a reassessment of a real asset versus promises. All of this is important. All of this I'll explain. Gold expresses all of those through reserve buildup, and silver is representing it through stress in the belief of the system. So they're both reacting to the same problem, but they're different layers of the same system. So let's start pulling apart some of that. So first of all, I think I mentioned that 70% of the metal is coming from something else. So 70% of silver is coming from copper mines, lead mines, zinc mines, and gold mines. Only about 25 to 30% of it comes from primary silver miners. And actually, if you think about it, that one fact alone explains a lot of silver's behavior. Because effectively, most of silver is mined accidentally. And I mean, just to go through those, I mean, the ratio of and you don't start a copper mine just to get at the silver, because the ratio of copper to silver that you're pulling out is something like 1,000 to 1. That said, a copper mine, it can make like 15, 20, 25% of its profit from silver that it's mining accidentally, but it's still a huge ratio between the two. Interestingly, actually, lead and zinc, both of those, their ratio of the primary to silver is something like 1,500 to 1. You get 1,500 ounces of lead or zinc for every silver ounce you pull out. So even though the ratio is much, much lower, actually a higher proportion of their profits come from silver. And with gold mines, actually, it's weird with gold mines, right? Because silver can make up as much as 20% of their haul. So sometimes you're only getting 4 to 5 ounces of gold for 1 ounce of silver. So the accidental mineage rate of silver in gold is by far the highest of the ones I've talked about, but it makes up by far the lowest amount of profit, of accidental profit. The reason being is that gold is so valuable that even though you're getting an absolute ton of silver out of it, the margin on gold is just so good that it, you know, it's 5% of your profits, something like that. So, you know, why byproduct supply breaks in most situations where you need more of the silver is because the output decisions are driven by the primary metal and not silver. You know, silver is a credit, it's a nice boost, it's not the driver. And silver price signals are, well, they generally have to be ignored by and just driven by the demands of the primary. So a copper mine isn't going to ramp up production because silver triples. It might extend a bit, but they're not going to fundamentally rework how they work because of a silver price. Well, not the level that we've seen so far anyway. I guess they could if it goes much higher. One of the things you do need to be careful of, though, is that of those, say, primary silver miners that I talked about, and they're only about 25, 30% of the market, you do need to be careful because they can pull this stuff out of the ground for about $25 an ounce. And silver is trading at 90. In fact, I let's have a look. Let's call it up on the phone. What's silver right now? Silver is at $94 as I record this. And like I said, they can pull it out of the ground at $25 roughly. So, but don't think that necessarily means. So even though I'm adding a note of caution, don't think that it means that silver at $90 can't last, because primary silvers do respond to the silver prices, and they will respond, and they will do various things, and I'll talk about those. But it does take a long lag time in order to be able to do that, and by long I mean a series of quarters, years, not many years, but still years, in order to ramp up production meaningfully on this stuff. But they can still, you know, you get what I'm saying. They can still put it out of the ground for 25. And actually, the capex costs in mining are horrendous, as are the energy costs. So they've got to factor that in as well. Copper, lead, zinc, gold mines are probably not going to ramp up that much for silver, because it contributes a fairly small part of their overall profits. Although in some cases it can be like 25%, which is very much worth having. So at $90 silver, you know, margins will improve, but behavior will change very moderately on those things. You know, silver's along for the ride. It's not driving the vehicle in those sort of other primary metals. Actually, the real pressure relief valve is going to be recycling, because if you remember, I said about 70% comes from other metals. And then I said, maybe 25% comes from primary silver mines. Well, there's a gap there, isn't there? And the gap is recycling of silver. And this is the bit that will probably grow. This is the bit that will respond. So it will be, you know, scrap jewelry returns. It will be industrial recovery will improve. And, you know, marginal materials will become, you know, much more economic. You know, whatever electronic components use a lot of silver, it will become more economic to say, okay, yeah, we're gonna fish those out and we're gonna extract the silver from them. But bear in mind, even with recycling, is that the collection is logistically difficult, and electronic silver is dispersed, slapped all over some printed circuit board or wherever it is, and it's hard to extract it. And so, and also recycling capability is going to plateau quite quickly. And then again, that's going to need to be bailed out. So recycling does smooth the spikes a bit, but it is not going to eliminate the deficit unless it remains high and persistent, and a lot more logistical capacity of silver recycling really starts to come online. So, you know, what actually caps silver price in practice? It's mining cost. It's, you know, the geological abundance. Yes, it is a precious metal. Yes, it is a rare metal, but it's nowhere near as rare as gold. There is silver to be had out there. What it is capped by is, you know, copper demand, zinc demand, gold demand, timescales, regulations, capital discipline of being able to get the capex into the stuff that does this. All of those things are making silver inelastic, as in it doesn't respond quickly to price. So what about the demand realities of these? Because unlike gold, silver is not a store and forget it metal. You know, often once it's used, it's done, it's consumed in many industrial applications. It's, you know, it's dissipated, it's completely uneconomic to recover it, or it's permanently embedded in something. And that means that the demand is not just investment sentiment, it's throughput demand, really. You know, silver does disappear, whereas gold mostly doesn't. I mean, I know I lost mine, obviously, in that unfortunate boating accident, but largely silver, you know, once you have it, you store it, you don't ever lose it. And silver demand, where is silver demand coming from? Well, a lot of it is industrial, as I talked about. Solar panels, they use a lot of it. Electronics, AI infrastructure, that's a big one at the moment, is going in all into that. Then you've got the investment tier, bars, coins, ETFs, who then need a vault somewhere backing it up. Jewelry, obviously that's a big one. That's fairly, you know, price elastic though, that one. You know, industrial demand is the anchor though. Everything else is secondary to the industrial demand. And industrial demand is price inelastic in the short term. You know, the silver usage is relatively small compared to what else they're doing. And the substitution risk of going to, I don't know, copper or some other high conductivity metal, you do get a performance loss. And so it is worth sticking with it. And redesigns do take years, especially reconfiguring the factory and the inputs and all that kind of stuff. So a solar panel manufacturer, for example, is not going to halt production because silver price doubles. You know, electronics firm is not going to pause making chips because their silver cost is high. They will buy at basically any price in the short term. So industrial buyers are forced buyers, is effectively what I'm saying. They're not speculators. Where substitution does and doesn't work, it's possible in jewelry, and it's possible in low-end conductive uses, and it can be built out in multi-year, you know, redesign cycles. Where substitution is not practical, though, is in high reliance electronics. If you want to build something, you really want it to last, like, I don't know, satellites, military gear, something like that. You're not swapping out silver. Solar panels, photovoltaic cells, the paste that on that, you can't really swap that out without big efficiency losses. In fact, if anything, you want a bit of gold, but you're not doing that because that's even more expensive. So silver it is. Defense, yeah, I've said medical, basically high performance stuff. That's all still going to need silver. So demand destruction will happen, but it will be slow, it will be partial, and it will be, it definitely won't be immediate. If you enjoyed that content, and of course you did because you are a smart person, then why don't you go over to lotuseaters.com where you can watch the whole episode for as little as £5 a month, which really is not much money at all, and you get loads of really good content.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.